if you didn't know, I did have surgery a week and a half ago, and they removed a lump from my neck. And it's, as far as we know, not cancer. We'll know for sure on the 1st. But things are going well. I had some people ask me, why didn't you tell a lot of people about it? Because it was Easter week and the week before Easter, and I didn't want that week to become about me in church. I wanted it to be about God, and it's easy to get distracted, so I'd rather... That's why I put the email out just on Monday before I went to surgery on Tuesday. And it wasn't because I didn't like you or didn't love you or don't covet or value prayers. It's because I really didn't want 2 weeks before Easter to be about me. I want it to be about Jesus and what he did for us. So that's why I did that. If you're going to pray for me, this Thursday I have a Mohs procedure. I have skin cancer in my head, and they're going to be removing that on Thursday. Hopefully they'll get it the first time. And won't be there all day, but we'll see what happens. So you can pray for that if you'd like. We're in Exodus chapter 12, working our way through and to the 10th plague, which is death of the firstborn. It's interesting, the prelude and the work up to the plague takes almost two chapters. The plague itself is four verses. So it's a real quick thing. And so that's where we are. We've made our way down. If you have notes... if you don't have notes, I do have some blank copies up here. If you want them, you can come get one. If you do have notes, where we are right now is on Aramaic number 3, or Arabic, that's the word, Arabic number 3. That is the obedience of Israel. Then the people of Israel went out, this is verse 28, and did so. So what has happened to this point is God has, in chapter 12, basically given them the instructions for Passover and the instructions for unleavened bread, these two feasts that will really establish and begin the festival calendar for Israel throughout their generations. It still is that way today. The festival calendar starts with Passover and unleavened bread. And that's where it starts at, which God said, this is where you're going to be the first month for you, and it's going to start for you. So the religious festival, and when I say festival, I mean feast calendar, doesn't mean, you know, party necessarily, but that calendar starts with Passover and unleavened bread. And what he's done in chapter 12 up to verse 28 is to give them instructions, very specific and very detailed instructions regarding how they are to keep the Passover and how they're to keep unleavened bread. So he does that. And then there's this statement, and it's almost an aside, if you will, something that's not seemed as very, doesn't seem very important, but I think it's one of the most important statements in chapter 12, because it says, then the people of Israel went and did so as the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did. This is complete obedience. This is the only time, I'm confident, this is the only time you're going to see that in Israel's history, complete obedience for this feast. When you get, even as they get past the Red Sea and into Sinai, there, even when Moses is up on the mountain getting the law, there is not complete obedience from Israel. In fact, there's such incomplete obedience that they ask Aaron to build them a golden calf. And then if you track their wandering, which we will as we continue through the Pentateuch, if you track their wandering through the wilderness, there's always someone kicking against Moses a little bit. And so, and then if you track their history through the period of the judges and the period of the kings, it always seems there's incomplete obedience on Israel's part. This is one place where the people did exactly as Moses and Aaron commanded them, and they did everything they were supposed to do. Now, understanding that the life of the firstborn's on the line here, it's a big deal. And so the question is, why here? Why now? What's happened in their history to make them respond this way? And I think what's happened in their history to make them respond this way are the first 9 plagues. The first 3, which affected them, the next 6, which didn't affect them, but they saw the effect on Egypt that had happened. And everything to this point that Moses had represented God as saying, everything that Moses said has exactly happened the way that Moses said it was going to happen. There's been no hiccup. There's been no almost the way he said it's going to happen. It's happened exactly as he said it's going to happen. So when they hear Moses say that God has told them, you do this, I think they were prepared in their heart to do exactly as he said to do, and they obeyed completely, which is significant. So what did that look like? That looked like they went ahead and on day 10 of the month, they picked their lamb. On day 14, they killed the lamb, and then they had the Passover celebration or Passover supper that night with their sandals on, with their cloaks on, getting ready to go because the next day is going to be the day they get out of town. So there was no hiccup toward obedience. So that's I think a significant issue for them in this. And then in verses 29 to 30, we actually have the plague itself. The plague itself. At midnight, which is what he said he would do, at midnight I will. The Lord struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh, who sat on his throne, to the firstborn of the captive, who was in the dungeon, to the firstborn of livestock. Pharaoh rose up in the night, he and all his servants, all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt. There's not a house where someone was not dead. That's a significant widespread plague. So at this point, the plague is the death of the firstborn. We've looked at all the other nine plagues. We looked at kind of the god of Egypt that was attacked or that was attacked in that god. In this case, every god of Egypt is attacked, but specifically Pharaoh himself. Pharaoh himself is attacked because Pharaoh couldn't even protect his own house at this point. Pharaoh, who would be the military leader, he would be the one who would be the protector of Egypt, if you will, the one who was driving things in Egypt, the one who was considered to be a prince of the gods. Pharaoh was, the pharaohs in Egypt were not considered to be just mere men. They were considered to be princes of the gods. And so when he can't fix this, when he can't stop this, his own deity is being attacked here. And so God is now is actually saying, no, I'm better even than you, Pharaoh. And that's a significant statement because remember, when Moses first comes to him and asks Pharaoh for a three-day journey to the wilderness to do a sacrifice, Pharaoh says, who is this God? I don't even know him. I don't even know this God. You think I'm going to let you go for your little bitty, I don't know who he is, God? And by this point now, not only does Pharaoh know who God is, Pharaoh recognizes, and all of Egypt recognizes, Pharaoh's subservience to that God. It's very clear. Very clear. I think something that's been interesting as we walk through this are the statements that are made, especially like in the previous part of the chapter 12, where Moses has gained so much favor in the Egyptians' eyes that the people, the Israelites go and they ask for their neighbors to give them stuff. And the neighbors just give them gold and jewelry and all this stuff to go away to give to them. And remember, they plunder not with military force, they plunder just by asking. And they leave with such bounty. And the bounty they leave with is incredible. We'll see some of that bounty described as we get to Exodus chapter 20 and following, where the gifts are given for the building of the tabernacle. If you consider the gifts given for the building of the tabernacle and where that came from, they didn't get that because by being slaves in Egypt. Being a slave in Egypt, they didn't get all this gold and all this silver and all this jewelry stuff that they had. They didn't get that just by being slaves. They got that when they went and asked their neighbors for plunder, for gifts, and they were given just amazing bounty as they left Egypt. The question I have always wondered and wrestled with is, why would Moses have such popularity with regular Joe Egyptian? What was it about him that endeared him to them? And I think there's a couple things, and then we'll just be real quick here. I think one of the things that they clearly saw was the honesty of Moses. What Moses said, Moses did. Moses said, if you don't let us go, this is happening. This happened. And Pharaoh would say, go ask God to let it relent, and I'll let you go. So Moses would go ask God for it to relent. It would relent, and then Pharaoh would change his mind and say no. So who's responsible? And I think this is part of the big deal. who's, I think the Egyptians saw Pharaoh as responsible for all these plagues that were brought upon Egypt. Pharaoh, who was arbitrary in his decision-making, Pharaoh, who was in some sense protected in his little palace, could get away from stuff in some sense, at least in their mind, I think. Pharaoh would say yes and then no. He wouldn't let him go, and all they were asking for was a three-day journey into the wilderness. You know, let him go, Pharaoh. What are you doing this to us for? I think that's part of why Moses becomes popular. I think another thing that is that reason that Moses becomes popular is, you know, if I do the math right and consider Moses growing up in Pharaoh's house, it's maybe likely that Moses could have been Pharaoh. And so if that's the case, you got Moses, who's a man of his word, Pharaoh, who's a man not of his word, Moses, who loves people, Pharaoh, who oppresses people, Moses, who is seeking the best of those he's following, Pharaoh, who doesn't care about those who he's leading, and you got those two guys played up against each other. Which one do you think you'd gravitate to? I'm not shocked that I wouldn't have been shocked if this had been God's plan for Israel to just stay there. At this point, I think it's very likely that Moses could have overthrown Pharaoh and become ruler of all Egypt. But that wasn't God's plan for it. Wasn't what God wanted to do. Moses was supposed to lead Israel to the land that they were promised by God. So there's that going on. So not only in the mind of Moses and Pharaoh now is Moses better and God better than all the Egyptian God, I think in the mind of basically every Egyptian now, they've recognized the power of Moses and the power of Moses' God in comparison to the power of their gods. And so when you get to the death of firstborn, I don't think it's an accident that Pharaoh responds, and there's this wailing and weeping throughout all of Egypt, a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where someone was not dead, and I don't think the people of Egypt missed whose fault that was. I think that they recognize this is Pharaoh, and this is what Pharaoh has done, and Pharaoh couldn't even protect his own firstborn son. Pharaoh couldn't protect his own firstborn son. And so so every firstborn in Egypt dies. Every firstborn in Egypt dies. Every firstborn in Israel, because they did what God told them to, they did exactly what every firstborn in Israel lives. And there's a significant contrast there between God's work in Egypt and God's work in Israel. And so the plague comes, and exactly what Moses said was going to happen. So what is Pharaoh's response this time? What is Pharaoh's response this time? Verses 31 and 32. Then he summoned Moses and Aaron by night and said, "Up, go out from among my people, both you and the people of Israel, and go serve the Lord as you had said. Take your flocks and your herds as you have said and be gone. And bless me also." Did you get that? It's amazing how Pharaoh's attitude changes from first request till last plague. Pharaoh, who had no time for Moses, Pharaoh who thought Moses served this little bitty God who had no name, who had no authority, had no power. Pharaoh, who basically, snarled his nose at the face of God, now comes to the point where he recognizes his son is dead, and he doesn't want them to even stay until the next morning. He comes to Moses at night, which is why Moses and God told the people, have this feast with your sandals and your cloaks on, because you're going to be getting out of town quickly. In other words, be packed and ready to go, and that's exactly what happens. They're to be packed and ready to go because in the night, it doesn't even make morning yet, in the night, has Moses come to him and says, get out of here. You just leave. Just go serve your God as you have said. Take everything you want to take as you have said and be gone. So there's the get out of here. So what happened? Pharaoh changes his mind completely. Pharaoh changes his heart completely. His heart is some ways finally softened. And he doesn't just want Moses to leave. He also recognizes God's position, because now Pharaoh, who is the God of Egypt in some sense, asks Moses to bless him. I don't know what that blessing was to look like. I don't know what he was expecting. I don't know if he wanted Moses somehow to, I don't know if he's standing there with his firstborn son dead in his arms and says, in some sense, bless me, which is, can you bring him back to life? Can you do that for me? I don't know if that's what he expected. He expected some kind of a blessing, though, some kind of a good word, something good from Moses through Moses to him to offset this tragedy that's happened in all of Egypt. I think Pharaoh understood the shaky ground on which he was standing in Egypt right now. And so he's asking for God to bless him. That just shows the work of God throughout the 10 plagues and what needed to happen for Pharaoh to respond the way that Pharaoh did. So it's interesting. Remember when Moses goes back the first time, Moses is heading back and God appears to him and says, okay, here's what's going to happen. You're going to tell Pharaoh this: Israel's my firstborn, and you have mistreated my firstborn. And because of the way you've mistreated my firstborn, I'm going to have your firstborn in their place. Pharaoh completely blew that off, but God always knew what he was going to do. He always knew what he was going to accomplish. And from day one of the 10 plagues, this was the ultimate thing that was going to happen, was death of Pharaoh's firstborn. Not only Pharaoh's firstborn, but the firstborn of all of Egypt. And so based on that now, Pharaoh responds and says, get out of here, go, leave. And so now the stage is set for the actual exodus, the actual out of Egypt. Ron, go ahead.
Just a historical note that I believe that this Pharaoh was Thutmose III, and his firstborn son, and the only son by his chief wife, was a guy named Amenemhat, who is known from history to have died within a small period of time from unknown causes, along with the chief wife, who was probably, I would guess, killed for letting this happen to her son.
Yeah.
As a result, the next pharaoh was Amenhotep II, who was the son by a minor wife named Sakia. And this is a much less strong succession because of that fact that she's a secondary wife, a secondary son.
I do think it's interesting that history actually walks alongside the Exodus. And where you date it, that what Ron said is true. There Pharaoh's firstborn son actually does die in Egyptian history, dies. And so the succession is weakened, greatly weakened, with who would be the next pharaoh. And so I think it's important and safe to say that Egypt was drastically affected by these plagues for many, 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 many years to come because of what happened and because of the hardening of Pharaoh's heart, both on his part and on God's part, to accomplish his purpose to get Israel out of Egypt and to move them to the land that he had promised them. So 400 years now, 430 years ago, Israel went down into Egypt. Jacob and his 70 went down into Egypt. 430 years later now, after all this stage has been set, now they're going to be leaving. They're going to be leaving. They went down as 70. They're coming out as about 2 million people. They went down as a family. They're coming out as a nation. They've grown into this great nation there. They went down as as shepherds. They're coming out as shepherds and brickmakers, and because of what Moses learned in Pharaoh's house, I think they're coming out as an army. They're going to get training, definitely in the wilderness, and they're going to become an army that's a pretty strong force, especially as they hit 40 years later and they enter into the promised land to dispossess all the people. They're going to be effective at dispossessing people. I know part of, a lot of that is God's work in them, but there's still the idea of their own ability militarily. So that's what's happened. The changes that have happened in that 430 years have been drastic changes for them. They went down with a knowledge of God. Jacob had a personal, familial knowledge of God. They're coming out with a practical knowledge of God. They went down with promises of God help from famine. They come out with a promise of God to take them to a land and to build them into a nation. There's drastic changes that happen to Israel while they're in Egypt. And I think it was a necessary time for them to become who they need to be. Now we're getting ready. Exodus actually 12, verse 33 is where the actual Exodus happens. You don't have this in your notes. Think we're going to get through seven verses is excessive and extensive, so I'll have these for you next. But if you want to write on the bottom of this page, you can write out of Egypt. Out of Egypt. That's our next section. And that really will then take us to the end of the book of Exodus. Out of Egypt. And the first is going to be actually the Exodus itself. It starts at Exodus 12, verse 33, and then we'll just work our way through a little bit. I'll just talk through as we go, okay? The Egyptians were urgent with people to send them out of the land in haste. For they said, "We shall all be dead." So the people took their dough before it was leavened, their kneading bowls being bound up in their cloaks and their shoulders. The people of Israel had also done as Moses told them. They had asked the Egyptians for silver and gold jewelry and fine clothing. The Lord had given the people favor in the sight of all the Egyptians so that they let them have what they asked. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. So here's what happens. Now, not only has Pharaoh said, "Get out of here," the Egyptians are saying, "Get out of here." Their statement is, "If you guys stay, we're all going to die. The firstborn went this time. If we continue, so secondborn next, and then thirdborn, and then who's left? Who's left for crying out loud? Get out of here before we all die." And this isn't the first bad plague they had. Plague 10 was the worst because of the death of the firstborn, but 1 through 9 weren't great. It wasn't a happy time for them, 1 through 9. And so they recognize, I think, two things. First of all, that God is powerful and their gods are weak. They can't stop it. Remember, first three, their magicians tried to offset or mimic the same plague that God had sent. And not being able to stop it, they said, "Look, we can do it too." Well, guess what? If that continues to be the process and death of the firstborn, hey, we can do it too. Kill the first. That's not what you want to do. And so their response is, "If you guys don't go, we're all going to die. We're all going to die. So you need to get out of here." And so not only do they say, "You need to get out of here," now they say, "And let us help you. Let us help you. Let's give you some gifts on your way. Gifts on your journey." It's interesting that the statement made here is that because they've gained favor in the sight of the Egyptians, God had that happen. God had made that happen. That when they went and they asked for things, the Egyptians said, "Take what you like. Take whatever you want." Whatever they asked for, they got. And so they, in a sense, and it's not my word, it's God's word, they plundered the Egyptians almost as if they won a military victory. That's part of a military victory, especially in those days. When you won a victory militarily, part of the victory was the plunder, the spoils, taking things. And so they, without raising a sword, Israel goes to Egypt and asks for gold and silver and fine jewelry. And the Egyptians say, basically open their storehouses and say, take whatever you'd like. Take whatever you'd like. That's not a natural response. And I think that response is because they've seen the power of Israel's God. They've seen what he has accomplished. And they are actually going to give everything. Now, what we do know also is that not only have some of the Egyptians, I'm not just seen this, some of the Egyptians have actually responded to this God. And they ask, can we go too? We want to go with you. That's in the previous chapter. There's going to be, I don't think it's a small number of Egyptians that say, we want to go too. Because they recognize what God has done. He's shown them the great God that he is, and they've recognized the fallibility of their own gods. They've recognized that their gods are nothing compared to this guy. And if you're going to worship a god, why not worship the guy who's powerful? I mean, can you imagine? I mean, think through yourself now as you're an Egyptian. The god of the Nile has been defeated. The god of the earth has been defeated. The god of the air has been defeated. The goddess of health and wellness has been defeated. The god of the sun and light has been defeated. The god of all gods in Egypt has been defeated. Let's keep worshiping that god. Let's keep worshiping those gods, shall we? Some people actually got in their head, they said, no, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm not worshiping those gods. I'm going to follow that god, the God who's powerful. And so there are a considerable number of Egyptians that actually get on the side of the Israelites, that's the word I'm looking for, and come with them. But when they get ready to leave, they ask for plunder, they're given plunder, they plunder the Egyptians, and they head out. And now we have the actual looking at the first journey that is here. The people of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, besides women and children. So here's the number of Jews, 600,000 men, okay? That's just counting men. So if you figure 600,000 men, you figure that most of those men probably had a wife. There's 1,200,000, right? And then there were probably kids. You figure two kids for each. There's 2.4 million right there. So we're talking easily 2 million people that are part of the Exodus. And you know, the movies, the Ten Commandment movies, stuff like that, can't even give you a picture of what 2 million people look like. If you remember the Royal, remember not so long ago when the Royals won the World Series? They actually won a game and scored a run. remember that? And down at Union Station, there was this huge, I would never have gone there, but there was this huge conglomeration of people. You know, there have been lots of different estimates about how many people were down there between, I think the biggest number I heard was like 88,000 or something like that. But that looked like maybe I'm getting my numbers wrong. I don't know. I didn't go. I don't care. But there was this huge number of people, and it wasn't anywhere close, nowhere close to even hundreds of thousands of people. And it just like the whole area was covered with people. Well, now you're talking about 2.5 million people with their goods, with their household items, with their animals, with everything they have, and they are now moving as a group around the area. This is a massive group of people. This is a massive undertaking that's taking place. And so when you consider what God does, it's going to do at the Red Sea by holding Egypt's armies off until all of Israel gets across. I don't think it took 10 minutes to cross the Red Sea, for 2 million people to cross the Red Sea. It probably took hours for that group of people to get across the Red Sea. So it is a significant thing that's happening here as this 2 million people move from Egypt to the wilderness. They're going to eventually end up in the Promised Land. But right now they're moving from Egypt to the wilderness. It's it's a massive undertaking that I don't think we quite can grasp in our heads. There's not going to be another undertaking like this at all. In later day, in the 400 BC, 516 BC, when Cyrus issues the decree for Israel to go back to the land after the Babylonian captivity, when he issues that decree, another 2 million people, no, that's not the case. When he issues a decree, 55,000 Jews go back to resettle the land. That's a lot of people, but it's nowhere near 2.5 million. Nowhere near 2.5 million people. So why am I even talking? I just want us to understand that the big deal this was for this nation to be moving as a whole through the land, and why it was that people heard about them before they got there. It wouldn't be a shock. You know, you got 10,000 people coming. Well, maybe not such a big deal. You got 2.5 million people coming your way. It's probably going to get some notice. And so that's one of the big deals about this movement out of the land. So they move, and here's verse 30, a mixed multitude also went up with them, with very much livestock, both flocks and herds. It's important we understand, what is the mixed multitude? What's the mixed multitude? The mixed multitude, I believe, are the Egyptians and others in the land. The understanding, Israel weren't the only slaves in Egypt. And I wouldn't be shocked to see if some of those other people that had been slaves said, hey, this is our chance. And they got in line and they said, we're going with you guys. We're getting out of here too. And not only that, but there's a significant amount of Egyptians that left. And I like the term that's used here, a mixed multitude. That means a lot of people. You know, in the Brian Neal vernacular, multitude means lots of people. So there's a significant group of folks along with the Jews that leave. So if we say significant group is 500,000, we're talking now 3 million people who are moving out of Egypt and into this next. You know how many people live in the Kansas City metropolitan area? About 1.5 million. So double that, and that group of people now is moving with their livestock and with everything they have. This is a huge, huge group of people that are leaving. And not only that, very much livestock, both flocks and herds. So to get out of there, they baked, remember, because their bread didn't have time to leaven, they couldn't let their bread raise, they baked unleavened bread, unleavened cakes of dough that they had brought out of Egypt, for it was not leavened, because they were thrust out of Egypt and could not wait, nor had they prepared any provisions for themselves. So they're gone. They're gone and out of there. And here's the summary statement for the Egyptian sojourn. The time that the people of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. At the end of 430 years, on that very day, all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. It was a night of watching by the Lord to bring them out of the land of Egypt. So the same night is a night of watching kept to the Lord by all the people of Israel throughout their generations. So the night of watching would be the Passover celebration. It was always done at night, not during the day. It was a nighttime feast, and they would spend the night watching. That's the idea. So it was. Now the scripture tells us that it was the very day. So the very day, 430 years earlier, that Jacob went down into Egypt, that very day is the day, 430 years later, that they left. That's what the Bible says. I'm going to go ahead and let it be the Bible and say that's what happened. Wow, you don't think, man, that's kind of a really hard thing to, okay, so you don't think God can orchestrate events so that it's the very day? I absolutely do. He can kill the firstborn on the day he says the firstborn's going to die. He can actually make things work so that it's the very day. It's the very day. So the very day then, 430 years later, they're leaving, getting out of land. And the significance of Passover to be kept throughout all generations is that night of watching where they would watch to see what God is going to do and see how he's going to do it. So that is the Exodus out of Egypt really happens there in verses 12, 30, 35, what, 33 through 42. And then one more thing before we actually get out of there, is actually three more things. First, there's going to be the institution of Passover, then there's going to be the firstborn consecrated, and then there's going to be the institution of unleavened bread. They're actually going to be institution of those two feasts and a consecration of the firstborn. God is not going to let the firstborn off scot-free. He is going to have the people recognize that what he did for them is a miracle, what he did for them is important, and he is actually going to get the firstborn for himself. But he's not going to do it in the way that we think. He's not going to do it in the way that would have been imagined. He's not going to do it by asking them to sacrifice their firstborn by throwing him into a fire or something like that. He's going to do it by a trade. Miraculously, God is going to have the firstborn consecrated because they're important, but he's going to have the firstborn numbered. And the numbers of the firstborn that would have been killed in Egypt would have been about 22,300. Then he has the Levites numbered, who are 20 years and older. And the number of Levites who are 20 years older is about 22,300. And he says, okay, in order to buy back your firstborn, I'm taking Levi, the tribe of Levi, as mine. I'm taking Levi as mine. And so that's why Levi becomes the priest group. It's because it's a trade for the firstborn. It's a firstborn trade that goes on there. So that's what happens in Levi becoming this special group of people. They are special throughout all generations in Israel. Throughout all generations in Israel, Levi becomes a special group of people. They become the ones who are the priests, the ones taking care of the tabernacle and eventually the temple, the ones who sing, those are all Levites. And they travel like that. Now, some issues for that. Levi doesn't get land. When we walk through the divisions around the tabernacle, we'll notice that the Levi doesn't get a place, because Levi is interspersed throughout all the land. Levi doesn't get when they're giving out land in Joshua. Levi doesn't get a portion. Levi doesn't get any land Levi gets cities, Levitical cities. Levi gets those, all right? But those are interspersed throughout all the land. The Levitical cities are there. Six Levitical cities, six cities of refuge that are interspersed throughout all of the land. But they don't get their own, they don't get really to even own land. They're not supposed to be growing crops. They're not supposed to be growing what are those things? Herds and flocks. They're supposed to be taken care of by the gifts of the people for the tabernacle and for the temple that are to be used. That's what they're supposed to be doing, which is why when you get to Malachi at the end of the Old Testament, and the priests have actually moved out of the land. In fact, it's so bad, the priests have moved out of the temple and have gotten their own land, are raising their own flocks, and are taking care of themselves because the people have stopped taking care of them. They're completely on their own, and not only that, where they're supposed to be ministering, where the storehouse of the temple is supposed to be, there's a Samaritan living there named Tobiah. He's actually living in the storehouses of the temple when Nehemiah goes back, and he didn't live there long. He didn't live there long after Nehemiah gets back. He takes care of that business real quick. So Levi becomes a special nation as a tribe, as a replacement for the firstborn who have been consecrated to God. I thought I saw a hand go up. Didn't. Okay. Let's go. So as we get to, I'm going to keep going because we got time and nobody's asking questions. So, hey, let's do it. I'm going to take advantage of as much as I can. So we get to verse 43 now, and we see the institution. This is actually the Passover is instituted as a celebration, as a festival throughout generation to generation. And I'll just read it here. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, this is the statute of the Passover. So the first statute, the first law Moses gets from God isn't at Sinai. The first law Moses gets from God is right here. This is the first time the word statute, commandment, or law is used with regard to the nation of Israel as a people. It's right here. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, this is a statute of the Passover. No foreigner shall eat it. But every slave that is bought for money may eat of it after you have circumcised him. No foreigner or hired servant may eat of it. It shall be eaten in one house. You shall not take any of the flesh outside the house, and you shall not break any of its bones. All the congregation of Israel shall keep it. If a stranger shall sojourn with you and you would keep and would keep the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised, and he may come near to keep it. He shall be as a native of the land, but no uncircumcised person shall eat it. There shall be one law for the native, one and for the stranger who sojourns among you. And all the people of Israel did just as the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron. On that very day, the Lord brought the people out of the land of Egypt by their hosts. So God separates now Jews and Gentiles, or Jews, circumcised, uncircumcised, and he makes a division between the Israelites and the foreigners who are just along for the ride. I believe there are probably some foreigners, some Egyptians, some folks who are just, and especially maybe some slaves, who were along just for the ride. They were getting out of Egypt while the getting out of Egypt was good. But there were some who would want to follow, seek to follow that God. Those who were just along for the ride, who didn't want any part of God, could not participate in Passover. Could not participate in Passover. But if one wanted to proselyte himself, wanted to become a sojourner and understood the circumcision part, and not only that person, but all of his house was that way, then that person could participate in Passover. They could be part of Passover. So there's already the idea of inclusion there of those who are outsiders. There's the ability to be included if you're an outsider by following what God is going to do. And that actually is going to track as we track through the rest of the Old Testament. That idea is still in existence. That idea of the proselyte or the sojourner who would worship God. And we have examples of that. There are people who do that. Yeah, Ron. Okay, well, so let me be clear. The Passover was not for someone who wasn't willing to follow God completely by doing the circumcision thing. That's the rule that God puts on this. If someone wants to keep Passover, there's a requirement for that, and that requirement was he and all of his household must be circumcised, and that's not just the ritual. That is a circumcision not just of the flesh. I think it indicates a circumcision of the heart that says we want to follow that God. And so you had to be willing to follow Yahweh, to follow the I Am, to be a part of the group that took part of Passover. That's the statement I'm trying to make. So, all right, it is 9:45. I'll have new notes for you next week, and we'll progress through the actual Exodus itself, Red Sea crossing. Red Sea crossing coming up. Let's pray, and I'll let you go. Lord, thank you for the way you orchestrate events and the way you exactly accomplish your purpose as you desired it to be accomplished. Lord, I pray you'd help us as we watch what you do in Israel, and then we put ourselves on display for you, for our own selves to look at, that we'd recognize the way you worked in Israel is the way you work in our lives, and that nothing is done by accident or chance. And I pray you'd give us confidence in you because you're at work. We ask this in your name. Amen. All right, you're dismissed. Thank